And I really sweated that morning. I woke up and was going to check the winds. In Mojave, we have some really strong winds. And at 9 o'clock, an hour before takeoff, it was ideal conditions. We'd done all of our training on a big, nice, long runway. We knew how to dead stick it. We practiced the whole thing. And that morning, between 9 o'clock and when we were going to fly, about a half an hour later, the winds came up at Mojave from a direction that they'd never come from before. Never blow in that direction, at least not this strong, almost 25 knots. First of all, it denied us the big, nice, long runway. And even with a huge crosswind component, we had to take off on a short runway going over town. And I'm standing there, and I know what's happening. All of a sudden, I found myself in a position to make a really a stupid decision. Had this press not been there, we would have just packed it up and went back and drank coffee that morning. But see, the outside influence to set you up for something, and I knew that was going to happen. And I'm out there, and they even towed the airplane out to the end of the short runway. And I was shaking my head. I says, look at the winds, you know, this is ridiculous. We're putting the townspeople in jeopardy. They're coming down with a strong crosswind. I got to dead stick this thing like that. We never practice on this runway. And he looked at me that day with just crying in his eyes. Now, he's not a pilot, but he looked at me and he says, Dick, please, you got to go. It's my whole company. I have investors here. And if we can, if these people come up here and we can't fly this thing, I may lose my company. I may lose all my employees. Please, Dick, you got to fly this thing. See what happened? Test and flight, sex and flight test. And so I made a dumb decision. Play the video. There's some over-the-shoulder cockpit video off the cockpit. And the lighter the airplane becomes, of course, the better the acceleration.
Push it over here, get a little more speed.
And a couple of, in 2 minutes, we're a couple of miles high.
Dollar pressures are nominal.
And then when it starts running rough, I reach up and shut them both off.
It feels like it's really kicking in.
They told me that rockets blow up when you start them. But there's a big fire truck there. And they blow up when they shut down. No fire truck there. At a rocket-powered airplane in a cockpit, you're a pilot, the only thing you recognize is an airspeed indicator and an altimeter. It's got all kinds of steam gauges and pressures and chamber pressures and stuff that are really very unique to an airplane. Okay, shut down, we glide back down. Mike Melville joins me in the left-hand orbit. And now with a real strong tailwind on base leg to do a dead stick landing on a real short runway. With really a bad crosswind. It's okay, Dick, when you start that turn, that tells you where you're gonna touch down. Monitor so you can tell me what happened.
We shot a little bit.
Okay.
So we did touch down in the exact spot in the short runway. And it all worked. I'm supposed to do a Bob Hoover, roll right up in the pits afterwards, but the crosswind and tailwind screwed that up. So I stop on the runway, and of course they have to come and get you because...
So how was the flight?
Thank you.
Well, what do you think of that, sports fans?
It looked pretty good. How was it for you?
You got it up and got it down, in spite of the crosswinds.
Yeah.
And you light those Hummers up and it climbs like a scalded ass ape.
Well,
Life and Times of Mojave Airport, the world's premier aerospace flight test center. And the main reason we're there and we can do all those things is two things. That little can, freedom and flexibility. We can take off in Mojave and retract the landing gear and descend if you want to, and fly for an hour.
He's not in there yet.
And nobody's going to turn you in.
The whole thing is in there.
How is it?
It's great.
Thank you.
Tell you what, it's about as far away from a long easy as you can get. Both engines lit fine, accelerated, lift off even in spite of the crosswind, and rocket power is very smooth. And then at the end of the flight, when you shut them off, there's a dramatic reduction of thrust. It's all instantaneous. Now, that was a great flight, and I'm glad you all came out.
Okay, that's
what they call this, the first baby step to space.
Anyway, that was quite a deal, and these guys are really great rocket scientists, and they've developed some really safe, functional rocket motors. And I was really privileged to be able to fly that. They came to me and said, "Dick, we're going to build a rocket-powered airplane. Would you like to fly it for us?" Took me about a half a millisecond. Besides that, they were just starting up. They didn't have any money. They sold paintings off the wall and hawked their cars just to keep going. And so it kind of reminds me of the other program I had, the Voyager, that we didn't have any money either, and a lot of people helped us. And so that was kind of the mindset that we did for the X-Core rocket motor. Anyway, those are two events that happened I thought you may be interested in. And I don't have any idea what time it is. Oh my God. Anyway, maybe it's too late, but maybe I can entertain a couple of questions if you like. Yes, sir. Was the Antonov ever recovered? No, it's at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. They tell me that at the North Pole, that the depth there is twice the depth as the Titanic. And the Antonov did stay it down, and as it went, almost went through the ice, it froze. And when we left it, it was still on the ice. But Ron went back a few weeks later to try to recover the airplane, and he couldn't find it. So because it was a dark color, I think the constant sun would heat it up, and finally it went through. Anyway, had a big thing to go and rescue the Antonov. You know, it's really interesting. I was standing there one day, and after we were down, and when the Cessna leaves, you're isolated. Nobody's talking to you. You don't know what's going on in the world. And you're just there waiting, which I thought was really neat. But I had a tripod, and it made a shadow, see? And so we tried to eat the fresh fruit, like an orange, and drink the water before it all froze. So I take the orange peel, and I put it at the end of the shadow. A couple hours later, I'd put another orange peel at the end of the shadow, and I realized it was going to make a perfect circle. And it's the only place on the surface of planet Earth that a shadow will make a perfect circle. Because the sun is the same level, and it just goes around and around in the sky. It's really quite unique. But the Antonov's at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. Follow your protocols. Anybody else? Yes, sir. I did. No, he asked about the fuel on board the airplane. There was an argument about how much fuel we're going to put on the airplane at the end. And I ordered quite a bit more fuel to be put on at the argument. And I did so not because of the engine. Remember, he's a smart guy, went to college, knows all the formulas and the slide rules and all those fancy engineering stuff. And my fuel load was based on nothing more than what I felt in the seat of my pants. I kind of had a feel for what the airplane could fly with. And so I ordered more fuel, and there was a little bit of controversy at that point, as you can say the least. But the airplane did take off, and we could have taken more fuel. Well, I used 95% of the world's longest runway, but the rate of climb was still pretty good. I'd always thought I'd get airborne, but I couldn't get out of ground effect. But we had a climb rate of 300 feet a minute. Could not believe it. I'd have been thrilled with 50. But anyway, I had this nightmare of the fact that I was flying around the world and I'd run out of fuel 100 miles short. And two things about that. One, take as much fuel as you can. But the other thing is that I got tired in my dream. I got tired and I got sloppy. You know, 2 weeks sitting there flying this airplane, you get kind of mind numb or sloppy. And had I not done that, I could have landed and been successful. It was a reoccurring nightmare. And because of that, I was bound and determined that if this thing failed, I could never look back at my, this is the thing with myself, I could never look back at myself and say, darn it, Dick, you could have done it better. You screwed it up. You didn't lean it right. You didn't fly precisely. And now you had this great opportunity and you'll never have another chance. You came that close, but you didn't make it, and you have to live with that the rest of your life. Boy, that was a bad nightmare. Okay, I got your question. Okay, the question was, he said one of the wingtips scraped on the ground, and that's a myth for some reason. They both scraped, and they both scraped equally, and the wingtips came off within a couple of minutes of each other in flight. So they both scraped. Bert said we lost about 3% of our range, and we had a fuel leak, and we lost another 3% of our fuel. But the fact that the airplane's capable, we only had to go 26,000 miles, from what is it, 24,000 around the world? But then the airplane could go 29,000 on ideal conditions without winds, weather, and all the other stuff you put up with. So we had a fairly good margin, so we could accept those kind of failures. Now, the reason for the reason that they drug on the ground is that, you know, some days you get the bear and some days the bear gets you. And we put more fuel than had ever even been on board the airplane before. 25%, these are round numbers because I'm not an engineer and I'm just a dumb fighter pilot, so I gotta have even numbers that I can remember. But 25% more fuel than we'd ever even flown before or even had on an airplane before, much less flown. And as I sat there that morning, things looked different. We designed the airplane so the nose was at the takeoff angle of attack. And you know there's an optimum angle of attack, this, you know, CL max on a wing airfoil. And if you're heavier, you gotta go faster to lift, but that angle is the angle you want. So we set the landing gear to set like that. So whether we're light or heavy, you go down the runway, if you hold the angle, it just lifts off by itself. The heavier you become, the more the wings bend up before it lifts off. But I sat there that morning looking at that, and the canard, which, you know, the boom tanks are hooked to the end of the canard, and they were bent down. And the canard was bent down in a bow. And it never dawned on me the fact that the booms were hooked to the wing. And as they twisted the wing from a positive CL to a negative CL. I didn't catch it. I don't think Bert realized it either, of what had happened with the extra fuel that we put on board. Some days you get the bear, some day the bear gets you. And we went down the runway, and all those 360 hours and 68 flights that we had flown the airplane, without exception, as we accelerate, the wings would always come up. And if we're really heavy, they would come up really high before we lift it off. And if you're light, they'd come up a little bit before we lift it off. But not that morning. About halfway through the takeoff run, the wings started to go down, not up. And they were down and dragging. Now, the reason that I didn't pull back on the stick and get them back up again is the fact that about 62% of its gross weight. Above that, it had an undamped pitch oscillation. And if you let go of the stick, it'd start going like this and getting worse and worse and worse until the wings had come off. We took off with an ultimate yield G factor of 1.5 Gs, or 1.4 Gs. If you exceed that, you lose the airplane. The airplane comes apart. So the heavier that it became, the more difficult it was to fly. Because you just let go of the stick and it'd take a little nibble and another nibble and bang, it's gone. The wings just flail divergently. My biggest concern was, besides getting airborne, that I couldn't even fly it once I got it airborne. Now I was concerned that even during the takeoff roll that all the structural dynamics are different when it's on the landing gear than it is supported by air. And I was worried that when we go down the runway, halfway down, they started dragging. Mike and Burke are screaming, Dick, pull back on the stick, pull back on the stick. And the reason I didn't pull back on the stick was that if I got the wings up, I may get it in this oscillation when I was on the ground, and the airplane after about three cycles would self-destruct right in front of us. And the thing was, the wings were down on the ground, they were dragging, but they were stable, and I left them there. And if you come to one of my programs, I'll show you that takeoff roll. And we got the takeoff speed plus a couple extra knots from Mom, and I reset up and pulled back on the stick, and the wings came up really slow. They kept coming up and coming up, and I said, my God, they're gonna touch over my head. And the airplane lifted off and accelerated to climb speed, which is 100 knots. And the thing that I was saying in the cockpit, and I didn't realize that I'd used all that runway, because I wasn't concerned about that part of it. My biggest concern was that the airplane was not even flyable, even with the world's greatest velvet arm pilot on board. And I was telling Gina, look, I can fly the airplane, I can fly the airplane. Look at this. That's good. And then I looked at 300 foot a minute rate of climb, and I thought, damn, we could have taken more fuel. We got the airplane airborne 1,000 feet over the field, making a couple circuits, but the winglets were just hanging there like that. And so I had to get rid of them in the local area. And so I dove the airplane faster than it's ever been and yawed it as much as we could, and we broke the right one off. And it fell in the lady's backyard, and if you want to see that winglet, it's in the museum over there. But the other one came off about 10 or 15 minutes later over a really rugged terrain, and we never recovered it. So they both shredded off. The reason you may think it was one, because I only have video of the one, but they weren't running video when the second one came off.